Now here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Our guest today was to have been the Vice President, Mr. Richard Nixon. He will be with us 1 week from today. Senator John Kennedy will appear on Meet the Press at a later date. We'll be on the air next Sunday, 1/2 hour later than our usual time. Our guest today is the Secretary of Labor, Mr. James P. Mitchell. And once again, on this holiday eve, the affairs of labor are high in the news. The Pennsylvania Railroad strike and the aftermath of the minimum wage battle in Congress highlight the activities of labor unions. Also, this month marks the first anniversary of the signing of the Landrum-Griffin Labor Reform Law. Secretary Mitchell has been the architect and the executor of the administration's labor management policies since 1953. In length of service, he is the third-ranking member of the President's cabinet. We'll start the questions now with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Secretary, we call ourselves a prosperous nation, and yet there are over 4 million people who are unemployed. Do you think it's impossible in a free society to give everybody who wants a job and who can work a job?
Well, Mr. Spivak, I think that should be our objective. I think in looking at the unemployment figures, one must also look at the employment figures. We have more people employed today, 69 million, than we've ever had employed in our history. We also must look at how we count our unemployed, which I think is very important. For example, of the 4 million people unemployed, half of them, 2 million, have been unemployed for less than a month. We have an unemployment problem, truly. We have about 800,000 people who have suffered long-term unemployment, and it is my feeling that we must, as a government, federal, state, and local, do what we can to alleviate this unemployment. However, I must point out that unemployment, statistical unemployment in this country, has to be viewed for what it is. Even during the war, World War II, when everyone who could walk to work really could get a job, we always had statistically 1 million, 1.5 million people unemployed, so-called, between jobs.
Well, Mr. Secretary, now the Democratic platform insists that every man and woman who wants to work, and these are their words, has the right to a useful and remunerative job. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's the duty of the government to guarantee such a right?
I believe that every man has a right to a useful and remunerative job. I think that our system is such that this is an obligation not only of government, but of the private sector of our economy, which is management and labor. Certainly, if we get to the point of our federal government guaranteeing to every person a job, we will, in my opinion, be deviating considerably from our concepts of freedom in this country.
Mr. Secretary, I'd like to switch, if I might, to the Landrum-Griffin bill, which is a year old this month. What would you say it has accomplished of importance thus far?
I think it has accomplished a great deal. First, it has caused the unions to report for public disclosure their financial affairs. I think it has caused changes in union constitutions to permit free and more democratic elections. It has given rank-and-file union members a place of complaint and grievance when they are aggrieved. It has, I think, brought up short those people, a minority of people, true, in the labor movement, who may have been using the labor movement for their own personal gain.
Mr. Rizal.
Mr. Secretary, you've been in office 7 years and very close to the President and Vice President. Here we have a railroad that struck across 13 states, something like $20 million a week going down. Mike Quill, the leader of the strikers against the Pennsylvania Railroad, says there's going to be a long one. This would bog down most of rail transport across the United States. In 7 years, you have not, and the administration has not come across, or any administration has not come across, a formula for the end of such strikes. Mm-hmm. Why, and what formula would you have for ending them?
Well, I might point this out, Mr. Rizal, that 9 months ago, many people were talking of a nationwide railroad strike. I must point out that the wage issue in the railroads, in all the railroads across the country, plus the work rule issue except for the operating brotherhoods, have all been settled through the National Mediation Board and through the use of the Railway Labor Act. In other words, the vast majority of disputes, potential disputes in the railroad industry, employing some 900,000 people, have been settled satisfactorily to labor and to management. Now, here you have a situation where the majority of employees on the Pennsylvania Railroad have settled their disputes with management, but you have a union headed by Mike Quill, which represents some 20,000 people on the Pennsylvania Railroad and represents no other railroad people in the country. He's the only railroad in which he is certified to bargain, who brings down a major railroad in our country on what I consider to be issues that are reconcilable. It seems to me that, one, the fact that a major labor dispute in the railroads has been satisfactorily adjusted throughout the nation would indicate the validity of the Railway Labor Act and the way it works. It would also indicate that in the case of Mike Quill, that the Railway Labor Act is something that he is not used to and apparently does not want to live with, because we've had a presidential fact-finding board. The company has agreed to accept the findings of the presidential fact-finding board, as have the other railroad brotherhoods throughout the country. But Mike, whom you know very well and I know too, has decided he is not going to accept them. Yep. Now, may I answer your question more specifically and say that I believe that reasonable people sitting down at the bargaining table can settle this dispute very, very quickly. And if Mike wants to be reasonable, and the company, I think, is reasonable in this area, he can settle it. Now, today, for example, the company is preparing a counterproposal to proposals that were made last night by Mr. Quill and his associates. I'm hopeful that reason will prevail and that we can get a settlement shortly.
Mr. Secretary, you made the point that it took only 20,000 out of the 800,000 workers on the railroads to shut down a major railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there is no power in the United States, regardless of the equity, whether Mike is unreasonable, as you say, and the company is reasonable, but regardless of the equity, there is no power in the United States today that can settle a strike that's crippling the nation, whether it's in steel or whether it's in rail or whether it will be in truck transport. Mm-hmm. You have a proposal?
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't it been considered in the past?
Well, Vic, the ultimate answer to what you propose is compulsory arbitration. And it seems to me that when the government gets into the area of compulsory arbitration, which means settling wages and working conditions, inevitably has to get into the area of determining prices. And for one, I would much prefer to see free democratic collective bargaining operate with the troubles and tribulations that prevail in it, than to see imposed on this country a system of compulsory arbitration. Because you know what happens when politicians decide wages, and this is inevitably the answer to compulsory arbitration, they decide in favor of the greatest number. When they decide, and all you have to do is to look at some of the countries where they have compulsory arbitration. You have more work stoppages, you have lower productivity, you don't have the great growth that we have in this country. So I would prefer to take the occasional strikes, which, after all, have been very little compared to the number of man days worked, than to impose a system of compulsion in America.
Mr. Brandt.
In view of the record of the presidential candidates and the party platforms, do you expect a high proportion of the organized labor to vote Republican?
Well, if the record of the past two elections holds true, yes. In 1956, Mr. Eisenhower, as the Republican candidate, polled a larger percentage of organized labor votes than did his opponent. And I think that the rank and file of American organized labor are going to vote as all other Americans, going to vote for the candidate whom they think can best preserve the standard of living in this country, the high wages they enjoy, the security they enjoy, and most importantly, perhaps in this day, best represent them internationally. For that reason, I think that the rank and file of labor is going to vote for Mr. Nixon.
But Mr. Nixon has a labor record. Some would say an anti-labor record. President Eisenhower had no such record. Senator Kennedy has what many people call a pro-labor record. And the platforms are, the Democratic platform is much more pro-labor than the Republican.
Well, the Republican platform is much more realistic as to what can be accomplished than the Democratic platform. But on this question of pro or anti-labor, after all, what does the working man of this country want? He wants most of all a job, and there are 69 million of them working. He wants some security. He's got security. He wants high wages in order to buy the things that his family needs. And all you have to do is look around, every one of you listening here, and your neighbors, to see what this country has in terms of housing. 62% of our people own houses today, never before in history. These are the things that I think, Mr. Brand, people vote on, and not on the so-called labor issues, which are somewhat technical. They understand jobs. They understand income. They understand comforts. They understand their children's education, and everything is very good in that respect.
Well, don't you think that the Democratic promise of $1.25 minimum wage, whereas the Republican platform is vague if it says anything at all, and you yourself stuck at $1.15 an hour,
mm-hmm.
you think the laboring people are not going to...
Well, of course, anyone can make promises. What is significant here, that in spite of the Democratic promise of $1.25 minimum wage in the future, which was 3 or 4 years hence, there was no difference between Senator Kennedy and myself as to what the minimum wage should be this year, which was $1.15. But the promise of the future, with a 2-to-1 Democratic Congress in this rump session, the Democratic Party was unable to produce it. So that I don't think people can exist on promises. They have to be assured of what can be produced, and I think the Republicans have produced.
Mr. Wilson.
Secretary, you spoke of compulsory arbitration, which seems to be a method of settling labor disputes, which is supported by a great many people, including, I believe, in this case, the Pennsylvania Railroad, which is on strike. There have been some other leading supporters of compulsory arbitration. I believe that under certain circumstances, Governor Rockefeller advocates compulsory arbitration. In spite of your opposition to it, do you think there may be some very powerful forces in this country which will succeed in getting through Congress some new phase of labor legislation which will include compulsory arbitration?
Well, may I say that I want to make the distinction between compulsory arbitration by law and voluntary arbitration by agreement of both parties. The Pennsylvania Railroad, I believe, has agreed to arbitrate the issues, which is a voluntary form on their part. Now, however, if labor in some areas and some labor leaders continue to ignore the public interest in the settlement of their disputes, inevitably, it seems to me that there will be forces in this country, which I think would be bad in the long run, bad for labor, there will be forces in this country which will demand that the government decide these issues. I don't think that's good, but if labor continues, some of the less responsible labor leaders continue to ignore, as some of them have, the public interest, as I believe the public interest has been ignored in the Pennsylvania strike, then there may be, as you suggest, legislation, which I would not want to see.
Just on one point that you mentioned, I have here an advertisement by the Pennsylvania Railroad, in which they state that the Congress of the United States should give the President authority to compel binding arbitration in a dispute of this.
Well, case. I would disagree with the Pennsylvania Railroad on that.
Do you think that if a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president are elected so that they can work together, do you think that labor legislation may move in this direction?
Well, I wouldn't venture to say. I don't know, because that's a circumstance which never even occurred to me, that there would be a Democratic president elected.
You don't think that's even a remote possibility?
Well, I don't think it's a possibility.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Secretary, you've been very friendly with the leading labor leaders of the country, and they've been friendly to you.
I respect them very much, despite
the fact that they're anti-Republican. Mm-hmm. Have you ever found out from them why so many of the top labor leaders of the country are against the Republican Party, if the things you say the Republicans have done for the laboring leaders are true?
Well, you know, this is one of the phenomena of my times, in that the labor leaders of this country can speak highly, as they have, if I may say so, of the Secretary of Labor and of what he has done in protecting the welfare of the wage earners of this country, and at the same time express animosity to the administration for which he works. I have difficulty rationalizing this for myself. And I imagine they must have, too, a little bit of schizophrenia.
Well, haven't they said that you belong in the wrong party? Isn't that what it is?
Well, this is their way of brushing it off, but I'm a Republican. I'm very proud of it.
Well, Mr. Secretary, have you any suggestions to your own party that might change the situation? You say that you're going to win votes from the union members, that the Republican Party will get a majority of votes from the union members themselves.
If 56...
Why do you have so much difficulty in convincing the labor leaders?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of history mixed up with this. Many of them grew to power during the 30s, during the Democratic administration. Many of them have perhaps had a more sympathetic hearing from a certain wing of the Democratic Party than they've had elsewhere. I can't explain why most of them are Democrats. They happen to be, but Mr. Meany himself has said that he does not attempt to control the votes of the rank and file of union members. And I think that the public ought to realize that an endorsement by some of the executive council of the AFL-CIO, which took place a week or so ago, is merely an expression of opinion on the part of those men who voted to endorse the Democratic ticket, and in no way commits the labor movement to such an endorsement. And I think these men would say so themselves.
Mr. Secretary, maybe this might help you a bit. The Democratic platform has pledged to enact legislation that would take away from some 20 states the right-to-work laws, mm-hmm. which protect a worker from losing his job if he decides not to join a union.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you personally for that change in the Taft-Hartley Act?
Well, it's an unrealistic commitment, because it isn't possible of achievement. And this is the cynicism, I think, which the American public views the Democratic platform in this respect and perhaps others. Here you have 19 states, I believe, who have such laws. There are 12 of them which are democratically controlled. The chairman of the powerful committees in Congress come from states where they have these right-to-work laws. As you know, I've said on this program and elsewhere, I am opposed to right-to-work laws. I don't think that they serve the best interests of the country or of the workers of this country. But it's unrealistic and I think untruthful to say to the American public, we're going to repeal the right of the states to pass such laws, because the very people that framed that platform know that they can't do it.
Unless the Republicans join with them.
They couldn't do it under any circumstances.
Mr. Roussel.
Mr. Secretary, you've been very close with Richard Nixon. Not too long ago, he charged that the reason for their abandonment of yourself and the Republicans was a deal between the labor leaders and Senator John Kennedy. What was that deal? What did he refer to?
I don't know. You better ask Mr. Nixon. I don't know that.
Well, Could you then tell us the difference between the labor policy of Richard Nixon and the labor policy of John Kennedy?
I think that one has to look at labor policy as to how it benefits the working people. And inevitably, I have to say to myself, that policy which gives people high income, jobs, and all the other things, with high personal income, is sound labor policy, and which, above everything else, prevents the cheapening of their dollars and inflation. This the Republican Party has done, and this I'm sure that Mr. Nixon will continue to do when he is elected. Now that, to me, is labor policy. That's the sound labor policy.
Mr. Secretary, just bluntly, don't you think that there is a deal between the labor leaders and the executive council of the AFL-CIO and the leadership of the Democratic Party?
If there is, I don't know of any, but you may have better information than I.
No, but don't you think that after 7 years of close collaboration, and we don't go into the details here, but it's obvious that you have worked for many of the things they want, the construction trades, common size, minimum wage, a great deal. They have abandoned you after saying, and I've heard them say, you're the best Secretary of Labor they've had. Now, wouldn't that insinuate that there was more than just choosing between two candidates?
Well, I would hate to think there was a deal.
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Secretary, as a member of the President's Cabinet and one who has a very vital interest in this subject, what is the administration doing to forestall a depression?
Mr. Brandt, I don't contemplate that we are going to have a depression. When you look at all the business indices, the high level of business activity we are on now, the growing population, which is going to place demands for consumer goods, I don't think that, and the easing of money, which is taking place now, I don't think that we are headed for a depression. I think that the balance of 1960 is going to be very good. I think the 61, any economist that tries to predict too far in the future always goes wrong. I do not agree with those people who would preach gloom at this time, because one might suspect that there is a political motive in so doing.
Not a matter of preaching gloom, and I may have used the wrong word when I said depression. I changed it to recession.
Mm-hmm.
But will steel and the automobile production be an indicator? Will they be indicators?
Well, steel production, as you know, has been at a low ebb. It's expected to pick up in September and October. This will be due to automobile demand. There is a projected automobile production for the 1961 models, I think, of over 6 million cars, which is a very good year. I see with the upturn after Labor Day of steel production, automobile production, a much fuller employment of production people than we've had. Steel certainly should not be judged on this basis of capacity of steel output. It should be judged on tons, and tons of output is pretty good in steel. It seems to me one has to have to add up all these indices. You have to say to yourself, Mr. Brand, how well are we doing? And we got 69 million people employed profitably in good jobs in this country, and that's very good.
Will you make a prediction for the next 6 months?
On what, sir?
On the economic recovery or recession?
Well, I would say that for the next balance of this year, we will have continuing high levels of employment, which certainly is the best indicator of prosperity I know.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Secretary, let me follow up on that question. Do you forecast that there will be an increase or decrease in unemployment?
And always in the fall, there is a decrease of unemployment. And we may expect the September and October and November figures to show an increase in employment and a decrease in unemployment.
I recall not long ago that you, perhaps it was last year, that you said by, no, I guess it was in 1958.
I said that by October the figures would be so-and-so, and we had, in 1959, we had a steel strike, which pushed the figures 100,000 over my prediction.
But you, and you but had...
I was right, basically.
You had to eat your hat.
But I was right, basically, yeah. Yes.
Well, you're not, you don't undertake to eat your hat again on this prediction, now, do you?
I would say that there will be decreasing unemployment in the months of September, October, and November.
But are we going to get away from this 4 million level? This is what puzzles so many people, is how you can have wide prosperity with 4 million people.
I think we are, Mr. Wilson, but I think you also have to remember what kind of people are unemployed. I mean, who are the unemployed, which I tried to say earlier?
A short question, Mr. Rizal, very short.
As a Catholic, Mr. Secretary, do you think that the charges that Mr. Nixon and some of the Republicans are using anti-Catholicism against Senator Kennedy are valid? Have you noticed any of it?
No, of course not. Mr. Nixon has said that he does not want this entered into the campaign. He so instructed his staff. I believe as a Catholic...
Mr. Secretary, I think that's going to have to answer the question for the present. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Monitor's thanks to Secretary of Labor James P. Mitchell and the members of the panel, Richard Wilson of Coles Publications, Raymond Brandt of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Victor Rizal of Hall Syndicate, and Mr. Lawrence Spivak for an interesting and stimulating half hour. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence C. Spivak. Now, a Monitor News special. Russian Premier Khrushchev has a reputation of never doing anything without a good reason and a reason that will further the communist cause. His unexpected crashing of the Finnish president's birthday party is no exception. For an analysis of the motives behind the visit, here's a report from John Chancellor in Helsinki, Finland.
Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev is on his way home to Moscow today, leaving behind him in Helsinki a number of Finns who are amazed by his stamina, angered at his impertinence, impressed by his power, and delighted with his gifts to them. This is not an unusual range of emotions caused by Khrushchev, with the possible exception of the Finns' delight in his gift. His visit here had many Khrushchevian characteristics. He said when he arrived that he hadn't come on business, yet he transacted some. The talks he had here with the Finns were described today as frank and youthful exchanges of views. They may have been that, but all the power in the discussions was on the Russian side. What Mr. Khrushchev did here, in essence, was to allow the Finns to do more business with the capitalist West. Finland, tucked under the eaves of its giant eastern neighbor, is almost wholly dependent on the Russians for trade and for political stability. The Russians have a proven ability to influence Finnish politics. A year and a half ago, when the Russians suddenly withdrew their ambassador, much of their trade and all of their proposals for extending Finnish-Russian trade, a Finnish government disliked by the Russians plunged into a 40-day crisis. The present government emerged, and the present government gets along with the Russians as a basic principle of survival. Because the Finns have to toe the line set by their giant neighbor, they have never been able to join either of the big European trading blocs, the Common Market and the European Free Trade Association, called the Outer Seven. The Outer Seven would have welcomed the Finns, but Moscow always reminded Helsinki that to the communists, the European Trading and Tariff-Lowering Associations were just a covey of warmongering capitalists. Thus, Finland languished in commercial exile, dependent upon the Russians for about a fifth of her total trade, and incidentally losing money in the bargain. Today, however, the Russians gave the go-ahead for more Finnish trade. Mr. Khrushchev had invited himself here supposedly to wish the Finnish president, Mr. Urho Kekkonen, a happy birthday. What he really came for, it developed today, was to let the Finns join the European Free Trade Association. Negotiations will be held in Moscow in November to set up the kind of trade Finland will continue to have with Russia. Russia will continue, in the language of international economics, to be Finland's most favored nation. On the other hand, the Finns will soon be joined with the three Scandinavian countries, plus Britain, Austria, Switzerland, and Portugal, in a club designed to promote easier trading. So the Russians will be the most favored nation of a neutral country that is itself commercially allied with members of NATO. This, said Mr. Khrushchev today, is a good example of how different systems can peacefully coexist. The Finns, of course, are about as happy as a Finn can be over the development. On the other hand, what have the Russians got out of it? Well, they have found a way to give a tremendous political boost to Mr. Urho Kekkonen of...